services, they don't use our schools, and they don't use all the things we care about in our community. And let me tell you another thing, they have no mandate whatsoever for these cuts. Nick Clegg, let's be straight talking, Nick Clegg lies to the people of Britain. When you lie, you should be in the naughty corner. So let's send him off to the naughty corner. Let's be clear about this demonstration and something that my union feels passionate about. And let the journalists and the media hear it loud and proud. We must oppose every single cut in public spending. No cuts whatsoever. And why do we oppose every cut? Because if we don't, we will have to choose between young people and pensioners, between public sector and private sector, between those on welfare and those in work. We should defend every pensioner, every student. To finish, there is an alternative to the cuts, and I'll tell you what the alternative is. Let's collect the tax that is avoided by the rich people in this country. While we're at it, let's start naming the scroungers. Sir Philip Green from Topshop. What a scrounger he is. He avoided paying £250 million in tax by investing it in Monaco. What an absolute scrounger of a friend. But you know what? What the government said is we think you're good, Sir Philip, so we're bringing you in as an advisor to tell us how to make the cuts. What shameful behaviour. So let me finish on this last point. We know there's an alternative. We know how brutal this country will become if they make their cuts, so we've got to be prepared to stop it. Now look around you in this park. Imagine what it would be if we didn't only march together, we took strike action together. Service in private industry, wherever you work, we are stronger when we march together. So let's ensure that we strike together to let the government go. So just in case, if you want to take action together, make some noise. Public and private sector, proud of each other, proud to be diverse, make the biggest roar of all and stop the cuts.
Good evening, you're listening to Behind the Headlines. Tuesday evening, it's just after 8 o'clock on 93.5 Unity FM Birmingham, the 29th of March 2011. And I think it's just after 8 o'clock, and you heard a rousing speech, from
well, I'll tell you who it was. It was Mark Sawatzka. He was speaking at the anti-cuts protest that took place in London this Saturday. Estimated 300,000 people.
Or just over, actually, some of the reports.
Yeah.
So, I mean, well, it's been interesting. I mean, I've seen some of the coverage of this demonstration, Tariq, and it had actually been quite impressive over the amount of people that turned up.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things we're going to be talking about today.
We are. We're also going to be talking police and
Yeah, we've got Steve Jolly with us.
We certainly have.
Steve's here to join us and talk to us about a piece of legislation that's coming in that was ushering in a new dawn in high-tech police surveillance. Steve.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Always a pleasure.
I'm glad you've given me the chance to tell people about this. I was invited down to Parliament last week. So on Thursday, I went down to Houses of Parliament to give evidence to a parliamentary committee that was scrutinising this new bill that's going through Parliament, the Protection of Freedoms Bill, which certainly sounds good, the Protection of Freedoms Bill. It sounds like there should be some good stuff in there to protect civil liberties and our rights. But they specifically asked me, because I'd presumably come to the attention of the Home Office through my campaign against Project Champion, and they're interested in my views on the CCTV elements of this Protection of Freedoms Bill. So I was only too happy to go and tell them what they thought of it. So obviously I had to do a lot of swatting up. I had to go through line by line every aspect of the bill that relates to surveillance cameras, and also the code of practice that sort of goes with it. And had to have an informed opinion on it, and I did my homework. And I went down, I didn't know what they were going to ask me. I suspected they wanted to ask me sort of slightly in connection with Project Champion, but
yes.
Sort of, I imagined that they would sort of want to reassure me and others like me, campaigners and people who are not a fan of surveillance. Mm. That now they've got this tough new regulation, it's going to reassure everybody that, you know, cameras are a good thing and they won't be used in any way which the public might not like, and everybody's happy.
So Steve, you must have learnt a lot about this bill now, you know, the fine details, the devil's in the detail. What can you tell us about this bill?
Well, the devil is in the detail, and you're absolutely right, because although it sounds great, it's called the Protection of Freedoms Bill, so, you know, it sounds great. What's not to like about that? And there are some aspects where, in other areas, where, you know, they've made the situation slightly less bad than it was before, but not so when it comes to CCTV. In fact, they're making things worse, because they're continuing in the direction that we've been going in, and they're kind of creating permission and authorization for further expansion and networking of systems. So rather than placing any limits on how many new cameras can be put up and restricting that, or even taking any down, that's not the purpose of the regulation. So it's not about restricting, you know, the use of cameras. So that will continue to expand and proliferate. There doesn't seem to be anything in there about protecting the privacy of the individual or the freedom from surveillance.
Mm. I mean, it's like, to a lesser extent, Steve, the speed cameras we're seeing now. I mean, it was like a few years back when homes were going on the road. I mean, they were putting those on, like, you know, tarmac has gone out of fashion, and it seems like we're doing a bit more like that with the CCTV cameras, and they're appearing every single street on our in the UK. With the recent events of Project Champion and you guys been campaigning regarding those cameras in certain areas of Birmingham.
Mosley particularly?
Yes.
Paul Green, Mosley.
Could the people actually trust those cameras after what's actually happened with the new regulation?
When you say those cameras, do you mean
the CCTV cameras in general?
Well, I personally wouldn't, because all the research shows that they don't prevent crime. They don't really reduce crime. You know, they don't tackle crime by catching offenders. So all the academic research shows that the stated aim, which is to reduce crime, isn't being met. And the Home Office knows this because it's commissioned report after report, and for some reason has ignored those findings, the conclusions of those reports. So you do begin to wonder, you know, what it's really for. And I gave the example to the committee that there's a village in Nottinghamshire, the village of East Stoke, that's just been awarded an ACPO, that's the Association of Chief Police Officers award. This award is called Secured by Design. And they've encircled the village and saturated it with CCTV cameras, despite there being only 50 houses and hardly any crime. And the police chief there said, this isn't about reducing crime, because crime in villages is very low anyway. He said it's about providing confidence and reassurance to the residents. So we've even lost sight of what the purpose is. You know, we just put it up like as if it's fairy lights, or, you know, just because we think it's a generally good thing. But there was a lot in the bill to be concerned about. It seems to be focused on improving the efficiency of the systems by upgrading to much more powerful new technology and linking cameras into databases that can interrogate other sources of information. So we're looking at a big, massive upgrade cycle. So I think we really are on the dawn of a new age of high-tech surveillance, and that this bill enables that to go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, these cameras, I mean, these are no ordinary cameras from what I've been hearing. I mean, you know, they're very, very high-tech cameras, aren't they?
Well, yeah, so the technology has developed a lot. And somebody sent me a photo the other day that had been taken on a high-tech camera. It was a sort of military weapons-grade camera, if you like. I don't know how many megapixels it had. Maybe it was gigapixels. I don't know. But it was a sea of faces, a crowd, taken from a distance. And because of the quality of this picture and the camera it was taken with, you could zoom in to any point on the crowd and zoom right up in someone's face from, you know, a quarter of a mile away, which, you know, is incredible. So when you see a camera in the future, in the near future, on a post somewhere in the distance, you know, it could be watching you much more closely than you realise. And this bill doesn't focus on the concerns about surveillance. It focuses on how to do it. It's an A to Z manual of how to conduct surveillance and how to carry on snooping.
So if it's not, you know, for the purpose that, you know, that we believe it is, i.e. you know, protecting us from crime, etc., etc., why do you think they're going to such, you know, great extents and probably spending a lot of money to install so many cameras across the UK?
Well, that's a big question. I think there is a psychological element to it. You know, we're told that it's there to make us feel safer, but there's no benefit to be gained in feeling safer if you're not. So if you're walking down a dark alley at night, thinking you're safe because there's a camera nearby, when you're probably not, then that doesn't do any good. But I think there is increasingly going to be an element of psychological and social control involved, and along the lines of a philosopher who, I don't know if you've heard of Jeremy Bentham. I don't know if he was a 19th century philosopher, but he had the idea to design the perfect prison, and it was based on surveillance rather than guns and bars and locks and guards, that sort of thing. So it was based around a central watchtower that could see every cell. And the occupants of the cell couldn't see the watcher, but they had to assume that they were being watched at all times. And this was seen as an alternative method of control, the perception that you are, wherever you are, you're being watched. And I think that we're seeing this being implemented throughout an entire country. I mean, Britain is the worst example in the world. And something that leads me to say that is that cameras seem to be getting smaller and more discreet, and we're now getting cameras fitted and they're being presented to the public as hidden cameras, covert cameras. Now, I think the psychological effect of that is that people are going to be walking around thinking that everywhere they go, they are being watched by a hidden spy camera. Now, some would say, well, that's good for society because people won't get up they won't be committing crime or doing something they shouldn't do.
But well, I'll tell you something on that note, Steve. I mean, me personally, just recently I've been dealing with the West Midlands Police, a little bit of antisocial behaviour I've been experiencing where I live. Now, they would refer to me that they had a CCTV there that was monitoring the people who were committing antisocial behaviour. But it transpired that in order for a West Midlands policeman to actually get the video footage of a couple of cars, basically, with some people inside, just doing nonsense, really, late at night. They would have to go to a place called Lancaster Gate in London, and that the CCTV could only be pointed at a certain angle as well. So what I've really come to the conclusion is that myself, personally, I've actually found that it's actually pretty useless, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, it's not just anecdotal evidence from people who've had an experience where they felt that something that would be of use turned out not to be. All the academic research and studies shows that it's largely ineffective. So you're absolutely right. But that's not the message we're given. We're constantly being told that it's the tool to fight crime and that is how we police nowadays. So we're continuing with the policy, even though we know it doesn't work. So, you know, is there another purpose? And I can't really say what that purpose is, because...
Perhaps,
you know,
it's maybe like, you know, you have these, like, Tesco and Asda these days. You know, the cashiers, but you have these machines where you go and scan things. The idea is perhaps less police, less physical police presence, which would actually be far more effective in actually defeating crime. Just having policemen there, you know, to actually help and assist you when you need them. But rather having these machines that apparently help you but can't do anything because they're powerless. I mean, if you're being beaten up by somebody, well, you know, what's a camera going to do?
Exactly. I mean, that makes me think of an example of something that happened, I think it was fairly recently. I saw it on YouTube. Not a bank robbery. It was a jeweller's shop that was being robbed by a small gang of robbers on mopeds.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen it, yeah.
And, what happens is there are three or four guys, and they're smashing the windows with hammers, and they're grabbing all the gold and the jewellery, piling it into bags, and they're just about to you know, obviously intend to disappear on their mopeds. And the video footage that was on YouTube wasn't from a CCTV camera. It was from members of the public who all stood around filming it on their phones. So they'd stood and watched and filmed it. That was their instinct. Mm. Oh, we must film this, because then, you know, we'll sort of, you know, catch the guys and bring them to justice. Meanwhile, there's an old lady who's across the road, sees this happening. She comes running across the road as fast as an old lady can run, and starts clobbering these guys with her handbag. And she actually floors one of them, and he falls off his moped. And I think that at that point, other members of the public decide perhaps we should join in and do something.
Rather than making, you know, YouTube videos with your with your phone.
So, what I'm trying to suggest with that example is that in the past, people, instead of standing around filming something, if they saw something wrong like that, they would have taken action. They would have done something. So either they would have tried to rugby tackle one of the guys, or at least they would perhaps run to a phone box, or they would have done something useful. You know, perhaps if a group of people crowded around, you know, they would have thought, their instinct would have been to do something. Whereas now our instinct is to be, as long as it's filmed, that's the main thing. So it's like, it's as if nothing is real unless we've filmed it.
Do you think it could be a sign of laziness as well? I mean, and fear as well, like, for instance, the incident of the bank robbery, where the robbery was taking place, and the lady, you could say, is old school, and she thought, in the back in the days, how we sort it out, we just go and stop the robbery, where younger people just film it.
Yeah, well, I think that shows the generation gap between those people, the younger people who have never known a world without CCTV, without you know, camcorders and that sort of stuff. And then you've got the older, you know, the pensioner, the lady, who grew up in a world where, you know, we didn't have this technology, and her instinct was to clobber the guy with a handbag. Everyone else, their automatic instinct was to film it. And I think that sort of demonstrates how society's changed, really.
I was going to say, another thing, these CCTVs also make good programmes, if you noticed. Watch Police Camera Action.
Yes, yeah.
And maybe it's a way of identifying, and also when you're showing crimes, to can like an education purpose, maybe?
I think that the use of CCTV footage for entertainment or in television programs does confuse people, because most people get their information or their understanding about CCTV from programs like Crime Watch. So, you know, which is effectively a kind of advert for CCTV, really. But you know, I would say to those people who say, well, of course it works. You know, you see the images released on Crime Watch and in the newspapers. I think we've got it back to front.
If I may come in here, Steve, it's all good having CCTV cameras all over the place. I mean, you know, fantastic. You know, it's cutting down on crime. But, I mean, we know, you and I know, and everyone else out there knows that it's not cutting down on crime. And half of the time, the footages we seem to claim that we have, we tend to lose them due to camera failure or, you know, the camera's been wiped off.
Getting back to this legislation, which is obviously currently in the process of obviously going through the various, you know, House of Lords, etc., getting itself ratified and eventually becoming a piece of legislation, a piece of law, which will bring in, you know, these new high-tech CCTVs, HD, able to, you know, do, you know, massive zoom-ups from, you know, great distances as well. This bill overall, you mentioned one or two things about it which are quite alarming, but it's, you know, is there any sort of major points that we should sort of, you know, take note of in this bill?
I think that what it does is it focuses on details instead of fundamental principles. So I'll give you an example of the DNA retention. The biometric fingerprinting of kids in schools. Let's use that as an example. Home Secretary said, it's wrong or outrageous or shocking that children are having their fingerprints taken in school without the parents' permission. Now, to me, I think it's wrong that they're having their fingerprints taken in school, full stop. But the key phrase for the Home Secretary was without the parents' permission. So what are they going to do? They're going to say, well, it's absolutely fine as long as the parents are asked. So they're kind of not saying there's anything wrong with the practice of taking fingerprints from children in schools. They're saying it's absolutely fine providing the parents tick a box and sign a form. And this is sort of characterises the whole approach. You know, the regulation of CCTV doesn't question whether we might have got it wrong with the construction of a total surveillance society, which is inevitably where we're heading. What it does is it tries to close the door on that argument and get everyone to agree that surveillance cameras are a good thing if used in the correct way. You know, if they're used appropriately, proportionately, and, you know, everybody's happy about the way that they're used. So that's what they tried to do with me. They tried to get me to agree with them. They challenged me about three, four, five times. They wanted me to say that I welcomed the measures in the bill, that it reassured me with some of my concerns, or that it was a step in the right direction. Also that CCTV had its place in fighting crime, it was a useful tool. All these things which I disagree with. So I was just disagreeing with them for about 15 minutes. But also I was pointing to evidence that I'd put together. It's all there. Available if you research.
Well, I mean,
and I put quite a convincing argument to them. They actually came and at the end came and spoke to me and said that was very interesting and I agree with a lot of what you said.
But isn't it amazing, though, Steve, that we can install CCTV every damn corner of the street, but on the other hand, we're cutting down on police force and trying to merge police forces and close down police stations. So where are we getting the manpower to actually man those CCTVs to actually make a difference on our streets?
Well, I think they're increasingly going to be privatised. I think the monitoring of camera systems has the potential to be outsourced to private companies who would run a monitoring station and they would say, okay, well, that bank of cameras belongs to, I don't know, Midland Housing Association. That bank of cameras over there is the city centre cameras. That's the railway station. So you're going to have private companies, quite possibly, monitoring all these different camera systems in one central station. And that's quite a worrying development because you're talking about the privatisation of surveillance.
Well, I mean, it is our security, isn't it? The privatising. In a sense, if you look at it, and isn't that a bit worrying that private company is going to be able to look in or monitor us 24/7?
Well, it is. People don't really question when and how they're being watched and monitored, and who's doing the monitored, and even fewer people still are watching the watchers, and we should definitely watch the watchers and then find out what they're up to.
We are coming shortly to a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM. Myself, Saeed, our correspondent, sports and news correspondent from RadioEthology.net, Humain, local activist Steve Jolly, all with us for the show. And of course, the sports will be coming up. Martin Summers will be joining us.
Yes,
and Tony Gosling will be joining us from BCFM.
Absolutely, and from with Martin today, actually, we'll be talking, we're going to go a little bit international, but we're going to concentrate on home today and the budget and a little bit on the rally.
Yes, two very, very appropriate topics are coming up, and I think Tony has discussed quite a revelation, actually. I mean, it's something which has been around for a while, but there's a little video circulating on YouTube with the former US General Wesley Clark as well, which puts a whole new light on the current wars that are taking place, or interventions, if you like. Anyway, do please stay tuned. We'll be back after this short break.
01-21-772-8892, behind the headlines.
Can you handle the truth behind the headlines? RadioEthology.net, 93.5 Unity FM.
There was a really amazing moment in George Osborne's budget speech this week, when it seemed, just for a second, as though he had glimpsed where he's going so badly wrong, and why, every time he announces his policies, Britain's growth rate collapses even further. It was when he held up Ireland as a warning country, an example of a nation descended into disaster. And I thought, could it be? Has he learned? Because, you see, until now, Osborne has held up Ireland as the shining example that he wanted Britain to emulate. Before the great crash of 2008, he said we should copy its model of tossing regulation for the rich onto a bonfire and reducing taxes on corporations so dramatically the country was classed by some as a tax haven. Look and learn from across the Irish Sea, he wrote. And his admiration didn't end there. After this model collapsed into rubble, instead of becoming wary, Osborne held up Ireland's response to the recession as his next great lodestar. The Irish government responded to the crash by making slashing their debt their first, second and third priority. They massively cut public spending at the same time as increasing taxes on the middle class and the poor. This might sound familiar. The result was that Ireland is now enduring the worst economic collapse of any developed country since the Second World War. But then, as the budget speech went on, it hit me. Osborne can note Ireland's collapse with sadness, but he's still religiously following their example, as if it all worked out beautifully over there. Osborne's budget was an enthusiastic mashup of pre-crash and post-crash Irish policies. From before the crash, he took the idea of just dramatically slashing restrictions on corporations and rich people, in the belief this unleashes the magical power of the market rather than implosion. From after the crash, he took the idea of making a panic payoff of our debt his overriding purpose. Never mind that our national debt has been higher as a proportion of GDP for 200 of the past 250 years. We don't need to guess where this leads. We can simply, as George Osborne recommended once, look and learn from across the Irish Sea. The primary effect of this budget will be to dramatically redistribute wealth. That sounds good until you realise the wealth is being taken from the middle class and the poor and handed to the only people George Osborne has ever really known, the super rich. This trend has been going on for a long time. Since the election of Margaret Thatcher, the value of wages in Britain has declined from 65% of GDP to 55%. Where did it go? Well, the rate of corporate profit, which goes to wealthy shareholders, has increased from 13% to 21%. The money has gone from people like teachers and small business owners to people like George Osborne, who inherited a big company from his dad. Yesterday, the process of redistribution away from you was supercharged by the Tories. The budget was what's called fiscally neutral, which means the overall level of tax in the economy remained the same. But money was reshuffled from one class to another. The huge cuts to corporation tax announced are being paid for by you in higher VAT and in worse public services. You pay more, so Tesco and Sainsbury's and Philip Green can take more. This isn't about attracting inward investment. Companies with higher corporation taxes than ours attract more internal investment by having highly trained and skilled workforces. No, it's about an inward transfer of wealth. I doubt there was a single person who woke up on Wednesday morning, looked out across Britain and thought, I know what's wrong with this country. Vodafone pays too much tax. But George Osborne has acted on this belief all the same, in part because he genuinely seems to have no idea what life in Britain is like.
That was an excerpt of a Cloudcast from Mixcloud.com by Johan Harry of The Independent, which is just after the protest took place. Some of his thoughts on the budget announced by George Osborne this week. And joining us from Bristol City, Bristol Community FM, well, our usual gaffs here, is Martin Summers.
Hello there.
Hello, Martin. Thanks for joining us. Also in the studio is Steve Jolly, our sports correspondent Hermione from Radiothology.net is here. He'll be giving us the sports very shortly as well. Joining us later will be Tony Gosling as well. But I'm sure you just heard that clip, Martin.
I did, yeah.
Of Johan Harry, you know. Do you kind of confer with his thoughts?
I think that was a very succinct exposition of the situation. Very well put and very, very carefully argued. What surprises me is in the opinion polls, the government's position on the economy is holding up. I mean, they haven't got majority support, perhaps, but there's still a substantial section of the population that seems to think there is no alternative to what's going on. And of course, what Johan Harry was pointing out there is that in actual fact, the key thing that, to my mind, is that the austerity policies that are being pursued are increasing the deficit, not decreasing the deficit. Everybody thinks that what we're doing, we're going through all of this pain in order to get down government borrowing, but government borrowing as a proportion of GDP is going up. That's because GDP is flagging, and therefore you don't get the tax receipts coming in. You just have to spend more on benefits. People get sacked and then they go on benefits, and that means that you've got to pay more out that way. And the Irish have driven themselves into a cul-de-sac. The Portuguese are about to drive into a cul-de-sac. And Britain, in fact, is not in such a bad position as those countries. We don't have to drive into this cul-de-sac, but we're determined to do it anyway. And it's I think there are two factors at work. One, there's been a long-run strategy by the very wealthy classes to basically capture the policy agenda completely and run it entirely in their own interest. But then that's always been the case. I think what's really underlying all of this is it goes back a very long way in our society. We're brainwashed from a very early age into the way our society works about money. You've got to save, and if you want to spend things, you've got to keep your pocket money and all of this stuff. And it's been going on for generations. So it's very hard. I mean, I used to teach economics, and one of the first things you teach advanced level students is they all come in thinking, they all say, well, you can't spend what you haven't got. You say, well, that's just wrong, because in actual fact, the economy is a dynamic thing. It's not a fixed cake, which you then cut up.
So, Martin, if I can cut in there...
It can be changed by what you do.
Yeah, if I can cut in there, Martin.
Yeah.
So you can spend what you haven't got, is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I mean, what you do is you have a vision of what you want to do. Any country can produce anything that the skills and knowledge of its people are capable of producing. And the money system is to be seen as a mechanism for getting those people to do those things. But it's a commonplace. When we have conservative politicians on our show in Bristol, they always come out with this, oh, well, it's like having more money on your credit card and you can't spend what you haven't got. But in actual fact, if the government spends in this situation, it actually makes the economy more robust, which means that in actual fact you've got a bigger cake, which means that you can reduce the deficit and spend at the same time. What we're really going to have to do before we get out of this crash and recession is there's going to have to be massive investment in people and in infrastructure. That's the only way we broke the back of the depression in the 30s.
One of the things that Johan Harry says in this cloudcast is that we've been in this deficit for over a century, from what you've seen.
I mean, there is an element of just humbug about this, yeah? I mean, countries like Ireland really are in a desperate situation with the bond markets breathing down their neck. That's not the case in Britain. But I think there's a more fundamental point here. You see, even Ed Miliband, when he spoke at the march on Saturday and in comments subsequently, said, well, we all know there's got to be some cuts. Now, at the moment, that's the way the mainstream sees this. It's a debate between the kind of cuts the government are pursuing or a different kind of cutting agenda from perhaps the Labour Party. But ultimately, you can't break the back of a depression, which is what this is, with cuts in public expenditure. You have to have a bold vision, like, if you like Hitler did in the 30s. He said, well, we've got all these unemployed people, we're going to build motorways. I mean, I'm not trying to advocate Hitler as a solution, but that kind of determination is what you need if you're going to get on top of this kind of crisis. But we've only reached up not even halfway through the crisis yet.
What about this high-speed rail business?
Sorry?
What about this high-speed rail business? Could that be a way out of the recession?
The argument in favour of investing in things like that at a time like this is it gives a boost to the economy and it's got some kind of long-term payoff, which the private sector would probably never invest in. Because I mean, they tried to build the tunnel with a private enterprise consortium, and it all fell apart because private enterprise doesn't want to take profits on a 30-40 year timescale. They're not interested in that. So these big infrastructure investments tend to be, have to be driven by the government, and also the government usually brings them on stream, or used to, in when we used to run things rationally, at times like this when there was a need to boost the economy. I would add a caveat to that, though. The thing about big investments like high-speed rail is that sometimes they're white elephants. If you think back to Concorde in the 70s, it was considered to be the most advanced plane. It was lots of British and French government money went into it, but basically it never made any money because it was just a prestige project.
Martin, so I just want to bring in.
Be quite careful about choosing which things you invest in.
I just want to bring in. We've also got Steve Joddy with us here, and also Humane, also in the studio. I want to get your guys' thoughts on what Martin's saying.
Well, I think there's a fundamental problem with the public perception of what's happening at the moment. We're in this situation when we're kind of bankrupt, or as the previous who was it? The previous Treasury Secretary left a note for his predecessor saying,
"Oh, the Chancellor of the Exchequer." Yes,
saying that there's no money left, and we've got these banks who live in a sort of risk-free environment, so they rake in all the money when they're during the good times. So when they lose on all their dodgy investments, we the taxpayer and the Treasury has to bail them out. So it's a massive transfer of wealth, where you see debts being nationalised and profits being privatised, and it's sort of the big sucking sound for this transfer of wealth. And I think it's a huge robbery. What do you think, Martin?
Well, I tend to agree with that. I mean, underlying all of this is the failure of the private banking system. That's why we've got public debt problems. In the past, public debt problems were sometimes because governments have spent too much on wars, for example, like in Vietnam. That was a classic case of government spending much money it didn't have. But, I mean, this has been caused by an unprecedented collapse in the private banking market. And, without the state stepping in, the private banks would simply have gone, disappeared down the plug hole. And maybe in one, some free market economists do argue that that's what should have been allowed to happen.
That's what Iceland didn't get involved.
They've struggled to insist that they won't pay. I mean, and that's quite interesting because they've managed to get away with it because they're small, because they're outside the EU. I mean, there's been a lot of huffing and puffing, but basically, the City of London, that is to say, the British taxpayer, has stepped up and bailed out the Icelandic banks, and the Icelandic people have managed to shut that off. The Irish, when they had their general election in February, were given a pretty clear chance to do that, but they fluffed it, in my view. And now they're finding that they're because they didn't. I think these countries will default sooner rather than later because they cannot pay. It doesn't matter. They can say we're going to pay, but they can't because their economies are going down. And this, of course, means that we're going to have a further banking crash. The most likely outcome of all of this is there's going to be another round of crashes. The governments will then be truly bankrupt because they won't be able to bail out the banks a second time.
Well,
and then we're going into a real crisis situation.
Currently, all the news is surrounding Portugal right now.
Yes, I mean, but they're the next in the firing line. The way these things work is the speculators, the currency speculators, pick on a particular country at one time, like bullies do at school. And if they all pick on one country at once, they can force them to default, and they can make money by selling their currency or selling their bonds. And so you get this kind of, ganging up effect. And, Portugal has now been the bullies have decided to pick on Portugal today. And they'll keep on picking on them until they crack. And this is very destructive. I mean, we shouldn't really be in a situation like this where this kind of destructive speculation can destroy, generations of people's work. But I think people still haven't understood the seriousness of the level of the crisis.
Well,
they still think we will be back to normal in a year or two if we tighten our belts. You can just tell that the majority of the population still haven't taken on. If you're in the direct firing line, maybe you already understand. the majority still haven't taken on board, nothing is going to be the same again. And when we really hit the crash, because we haven't hit the crash yet, when we really hit it, people are going to understand.
So in that
at the same time, simultaneously, of course, there'll be wars, civil wars, revolutions. Mm. It'll be pretty chaotic.
In that case, Martin, like you say, we will be likely back to normal in a year or two's time. If we haven't hit the crash, and we're due to hit the crash, and a lot of people have said that's going to be quite a tough time there ahead, and talk about double dip recession and then possibly depression.
Sounds euphemistic, doesn't it? Well, we had one little dip and we'll have another dip. What will happen if we hit a double dip recession is we have the crash that has been put off through government intervention.
Mm.
The government has intervened since 2008 to make sure that the system didn't crash. But the government is running out of options all over the world.
But if the crash was to come, which is inevitable that it will come, how do we then recover from that crash within, like, say, the year or two?
Well, what happened the last time, if you remember historically, is you had World War II.
Well, absolutely,
and,
yes.
And at that point, governments really got their fingers out and invested to win the battle.
Mm.
But, you know, no expense was spared. And well, certainly the wealthy were forced to pay huge taxes.
Well, I mean, even at that time,
fighting in World War II, they went straight round to all the stately homes and said, right, sell that, we need all the cash we can get. And of course, they weren't in a position to argue. And the problem is, you don't have to have a war to do the necessary things to solve the problem.
Was there, Martin?
It's only a war that generates the unity of purpose to do it. I mean, we could do it for peace if people were prepared to do it, but it's only when national survival's at stake or something really, really important that people are prepared to say, well, actually, I can actually be a bit poorer than I am, and that would help others, wouldn't it? So perhaps I can go along with this. It's just a psychological block.
I mean, you talk about World War II, though, Martin, and even during that time, from what we've learned, that German economy in Europe, anyway, I mean, German, even back then, their economy was stronger than
ours. Well, it was really weak to begin with.
What
Hitler did is he said, I'm not going to sit here and watch all these unemployed people. We are going to build Germany up, whatever it takes. And at the same time, simultaneously, the American leader, Franklin Roosevelt, was doing similar things in the US, not in the same way as Hitler in terms of the politics, but in terms of the economic strategy. And we've been talking about doing something like this ever since 2008 when the banks collapsed. But the problem is the banks have just collared the whole game. So as being pointed out by Steve earlier.
Yeah, I'd like to actually just take it back to
it. Took all the money, and then we've got to pay it all off, so we've got no money. But of course that doesn't work. If we've got no money, the economy won't work.
I'd like to bring it back to Stephen Humane just for a second. I believe I think Steve had a question or something to add to this.
Well, it was just this idea about governments going bust. I mean, if a country goes bust, then who owns it? You know, who's in charge of that country if the government's got no money and it's gone bust? To whom? To what bank?
Well, governments do default on their debts. I mean, what tends to happen is that when, you know, the banks and other people lend money to governments like the government of Saudi Arabia, well, they don't actually lend money to Saudi Arabia, they have the government of Argentina, say, because they're fairly confident that whoever's in power, they've got a taxation system and they can demand that money back. But countries have and do turn round to their creditors and say, we're not going to pay. It happens quite frequently. In the 1930s, every single Latin American country virtually turned around and said, we're not paying. And they thought there was a terrible, oh, no, this will be terrible. If you do that, you won't get any more money. And they said, well, we won't get any more money anyway. We're running the whole system to keep the private banking system afloat.
So just
the private banking system has become sacrosanct. So everything must be sacrificed so that the private banking system can continue to exist.
It certainly seems
that
way.
What we need to say is actually it's time to end the private banking system. And, of course, there are many ideas in Islamic social philosophy about what should be done with banking. And of course, it is the heart of the problem. Is this money making money and becoming a kind of parasitic growth on the real economy, where people make and do and service things?
So, are we talking about the World Bank, the IMF? Which banks are we referring to?
The World Bank and the IMF are supposedly public institutions, yeah, who regulate the private banks. But what happens is regulatory capture. So the IMF and the World Bank effectively become debt collectors for the private banks.
Right.
I mean, the original conception of the World Bank and the IMF was put forward at Bretton Woods in 1944 by Keynes, the British economist, famous British economist and others, was that they would basically discipline yes. the private sector. But what's happened, of course, is that the private sector just does not want to be disciplined. And it's just on having its own way.
We're about 5 minutes to the break, and I believe we were going to talk just briefly on the march that happened in London this weekend, or Saturday as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously this is related to what we're talking about, isn't it? Because people were protesting about the cuts that are going to affect them and their communities. I think it was quite encouraging to see the large numbers, but again, I think we shouldn't exaggerate that, because a large section of the population have already made up their mind this government is opposed to their interests. But it's not an overwhelming majority yet. There are a lot of people still sitting on the fence because of the reasons we were saying earlier, because they don't really understand how the economy works, frankly. It sounds plausible what the government says they're doing, and it'll take a rude shock before people wake up out of that. But, I mean, obviously a bit disturbing was some of the violence at the end of the march. Predictable, I think. I know some of the kind of people who engage in this kind of thing, and they're just not open to rational argument about it. They're very convinced that by going and throwing a brick through a window, they're making a political point. But I think many of the other demonstrators, certainly most of them on the mainstream march, would not agree with them.
Well, I mean, considering the number of people that attended, just over 300,000, I think the violence was quite low-key, I mean...
Well, exactly, and wouldn't it have been so much better if we didn't have any at all?
Well, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, so that we could have demonstrated our discipline and determination. And our refusal to give in. I mean, there was a bit of a wobble on the stage as well, as we said, because Ed Miliband can't quite come out and say, well, we're not having any cuts at all. The Labour Party's economic policy is in a bit of a kind of transitional stage at the moment.
If the Labour Party, if they are re-elected in the next general election, which is, say, 3-4 years' time...
Which is highly likely.
Well, absolutely. Are they likely
to...
It's
a very long time in these circumstances. We could have anything happening between now and then. We could have a nuclear attack. And there might not be another general election. Think it's, you know, don't be so blasé. I mean, an election could be quicker as well if the coalition collapses.
Well, yes, but what I'm saying is, I mean, do you think, I mean... the cuts that Cameron's making with his cronies at the moment, do you think Miliband will actually turn those around? Because I can't see him doing that.
No, well, I think the problem is that every step you take further into the swamp, the more difficulties you get into, and therefore it's more difficult to turn back. But I would say that, to be honest with you, my own personal assessment is unless you have a big shock, consumer society will not accept the necessary changes that are required. I mean, if you're going to get out of this kind of situation, you need huge, huge government intervention, and not for war. You need to build. I mean, one of my pet things is, why don't we have lots of really first-class nursery schools everywhere to make a huge difference to the quality of life for everybody? Mm-hmm. Why haven't we got them? They have them in other parts of the world, in Scandinavia, not in Britain. Why not? We're a wealthy enough society to afford that. Let's build them and staff them. And we need a vision of what we want, and then we'll find the money to do it. But that kind of radicalism will only take root when people have had a very, very nasty shock.
And in your personal opinion, Martin, how likely is that rude awakening for all
of
us?
I think they're going to get a nasty shock, but the danger is that when people have a nasty shock is that they don't get rational, they get irrational.
Yeah, this
and
is
so you then start people saying, well, the real problem is the immigrants. The real problem is radical Islam. The real problem is you know, whatever the scapegoat's going to be. And we've seen that happen in the past as well. So people don't go, oh my goodness, of course capitalism doesn't work. We need to reform it. They start all of the stuff comes up out of the sewer. All of the stuff that's not rational. And that, of course, is the real danger. And of course, you know, we can see the potential for war staring us in the face.
We've also got our sports correspondent here, Humain, who also, I think, has a few thoughts to share on this as well.
I just want to ask, what are the ramifications of Britain in going into troubled times? The people, like you said, are looking for excuses. What are the ramifications for that?
Well, I think I would hope that British society is sophisticated and civilised enough to have a robust discussion about what's required. But the danger is that even in civilised societies, people basically pull up the drawbridge when they're in fear. They don't, in fact, think rationally, and they start to blame scapegoats. I mean,
the trouble is, also, here's where the press doesn't help a lot. I mean, I picked up a copy of the Times. this week. It was sometime last week. I picked up a copy of the Times, and amazingly, there was an article in the Times about, you know, potential terrorist attacks from Libya. You know, as in, you know, retaliatory revenge acts.
And yeah, I thought, well, I mean, that's because Ken Clark made that comment about another Lockerbie. If
that's the one.
Because of Gaddafi. But listen, we've talked about this on this program before. It's not at all proven that that Libya did Lockerbie at all. The serious money, and I'm speaking now about Susan Lindau, who's an ex-CIA agent, who's just been writing about this week and in contact with. So, well, we think what that was, she thinks what that was the CIA were involved in a heroin smuggling operation from Beirut.
Yes.
Which was about to be exposed by elements of their own security forces. And that plane was blown up, according to her, because those people were on the plane flying back to Washington to explain to the senior people what the CIA was up to.
Unfortunately, Martin, unfortunately, once again, we are a minute away from the break. We need a longer show. It's flown by this week. It really has already.
It certainly have.
We'd like to say thanks to Martin, as always, for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure, and let's keep up the dialogue, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Coming up in the next segment will be our sports correspondent, Humayun, with the roundup of the week's sports. Also, Tony Gosling will be joining us as well from BCFM as well. So,
Tony
will
also be with us, and of course, you back at home on a 1-to-1, 77-88-92. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM. Back after the break.
Can you handle the truth behind the headlines? RadioThorrington.net, 93.5 Unity FM.
Daddy, can I have my pocket money, please?
You can't have any pocket money because Mummy and Daddy have no money left. In fact, Mummy and Daddy are in terrible, terrible debt. And we're going to have to make some cuts. So from now on, you can't have any pocket money.
But that's not fair. It's not my fault you're in debt. I've been good, but you've wasted all our money on gambling and drinking. You've been reckless with our future.
Well, you have to realise that we're all in this together. And so you're going out to work. Up the chimneys.
Here's the money I earned, Daddy.
Thanks.
Can I have my pocket money now?
I'm afraid not. You see, this money is your contribution to our debt. And this money is my bonus.
I do all the work and you take all the money.
Look, Mummy and I have been talking and I'm afraid we're going to have to let you go. We can't afford to keep you anymore. I'm sorry, but... Well, go on. Close the door behind you.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM. I'm Tariq Ziad, with me is Syed Ahmed. Steve Jolly is joining us, our local activist. And we also have our sports correspondent, Humayun, from www.radiothology.net. Before we go to Humayun, that clip we just played you is a satirical little advert from an organisation called False Economy. That's www.falseeconomy.org.uk. They are involved in the protest rallies on Saturday as well, and I think that's a very nice, succinct little way of summarising our current situation. But we also have Tony Gosling joining us very shortly from BCFM. Before we do that, it's that time again for our weekly roundup of sports for Maine.
Good evening, everyone. So, Roll, this is more than a game, it's a sports. This game is like a war, but without the missiles, with the
absolutely
bombs.
Well, indeed, yeah. I've also read that, you know, sports on a kind of like the international scale and the entertainment side really was something that was developed by the Romans. And, you know, of course, I like sports and people do like it, but obviously one thing that it can do, it can serve as a distraction. There'll be more sports with Humayun next week as well, our correspondent from www.radiothology.net. Do check out that station. You know, there's lots of good shows going out as we speak right now, and there's lots of great new shows coming out in the future. It's for the 16 to 24 demographic, and you're going to get a really kind of like a unique blend.
And of course, what's more, actually, me and Tariq are on there, so that's an incentive for you guys to tune in anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you really are, you know, a bit sort of twisted and you like the sound of our voice, and
absolutely, if you're in a fan club.
Okay. I've got a bit of audio to play. This audio is played by Tony Gosling.
We have Tony hanging on the line, actually.
Tony.
Yeah, guys, just before we get off the sporting topic, I think, you know, what you picked up George Orwell's quote is absolutely spot on there. War without the missiles. Well, I don't know if actually missiles were common. War without the bullet.
Yeah.
It is a bit like that. I think the distinction I've made is between people who participate in sport and people who spectate. Because this is actually, in a way, I think it's a bad idea to get into sport just as a spectator. In a way, it sort of trains us all to be spectators on society and spectators on the world. What we really all should be doing is getting down there on the field and taking part in civic society.
Mm.
I mean, I'm not talking about necessarily in the unfunded big society way that David Cameron's been saying, but, you know, I think, it's important for all of us to feel that politics is something for us. And not for us to sit back and just watch it happening. I mean, it is very dispiriting sometimes to see things going wrong, but then ask yourself the question, if I was to participate, could I actually start turning the ship away from the iceberg and into something else? So,
well, why not?
It's the sport, it's this whole thing of the spectator mentality that I fight against, really. I think, you know, I've no problem with watching the cricket, particularly, I love it. You know, you've got the thing about cricket is with this match, India-Pakistan game, for example, is you can have the cricket on in the corner. You don't have to keep watching it. You can be going about doing stuff. You know, I much prefer this to football, in fact. And then all of a sudden, you'll hear a cheer from the TV. You can turn around, watch the TV, and you can see the replay. And you can catch all the action and have it almost as if this is, you know, you're there. But you can't really do that with football. You've got to sort of concentrate and watch it more and more. But
it's very intense.
I love the way that the cricket can be on almost all day in the corner of the room on the telly. And whenever there's something exciting happens, you can just stop what you're doing and go and peer over at the telly. And I think that's a lovely way to actually watch sport. But beware of being just a spectator, particularly for young people. Get out there and play the sport. Don't just be a spectator.
Indeed. Now, I'm going to play this audio, which you've also played on your show on Friday, Tony. It's retired US General Wesley Clark.
Oh, yes, that's right, yeah.
Basically, it's a bit of a revelation, actually. It's something I found very surprising when I came across it. But I'm not going to say too much. Let's play the audio, and we'll come back and we'll talk about it.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon, and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me, and one of the generals called me, and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, no. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office, today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
Well, you just heard that clip there of a retired U.S. general.
The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa. The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you, but there was definitely, there's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region.
I slightly preempted myself there, but that was actually a clip of retired U.S. General Wesley Clark speaking on the astonishing revelation that in actual fact, the wars that have taken place in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that would actually, of course, include the current military intervention in Libya as well, actually appear to be premeditated. On this point, I'd like to bring back Tony. Tony?
Yeah, I mean, I think let's also be fair. I mean, he was saying in a much shorter time span that we were talking about that these countries were, the US was planning this. This is the Pentagon, which is this kind of, you know, war machine that seems rather too connected up with the private military companies and with the State Department. You know, the US, the democratic side of things seems to be a bit of a sideline. They've just decided this is what they want to do. But, you know, the problem here is, you know, that this is what they're actually planning for. I remember actually talking to a guy who'd worked in the Pentagon and also was in naval intelligence, and he was over here in Britain for a while, and he said that while he was in the Pentagon, he actually saw the US plans to invade Britain, believe it or not. He actually had a look at these plans, where it involved paratrooping US soldiers into Britain, instituting a US chain of command in the UK. And so when you're planning for these kinds of things in the Pentagon, the temptation is not to just leave those plans sitting on the shelf, but it's actually to implement them and use them. And it seems pretty clear to me that that Gaddafi and the oil that he rules over, or did rule over in the east of Libya particularly, have been a thorn in the side of the US for a long time. They actually really want to dominate the region. And of course they're aligned with Israel. So what you've got here is a sort of almost a war by proxy, where the Israelis are kind of sort of hanging back, but they're letting the US do these interventions. The US are now trying to pull back from Libya and let the Europeans take a more of a leading role. But nevertheless, the US and Israel are, you know, still key players here. They'll be watching very, very closely what's going on in London and seeing what's going to happen in Libya. I'd also like to say, I mean, I'm really disgusted with, you know, this mission creep that we've been seeing. To begin with, we're sold this thing of we're going to institute a no-fly zone, which is a pretty simple concept. It means that the few Mirages and other jets that that Colonel Gaddafi has under his command will not be allowed to fly around and to bomb. But then the mission creep has set in, and we're putting MI6 agents with explosives and machine guns in on the ground. That isn't a no-fly zone. We're also now bombing nightly, it seems, Gaddafi's facilities, including his headquarters and other areas where clearly there will be civilians being killed, because the civilians who support Gaddafi are actually going to these sites, sort of making sure that their presence is felt, they're being seen as human shields, and making sure that the West knows that there will be civilian casualties when these Gaddafi's places take
over. I mean, there are a couple of things that come out today, you know, but regarding Gaddafi, that in Libya, people, you know, the no-fly zone, I mean, NATO now has taken over control from the United Nations, and Obama actually said we are there to protect the Libyan public, and also William Hague, the Foreign Secretary, he said we're not there to change regime, but we're there to protect the people. I mean, by pumping them with the depleted uranium, how is that protecting the civilians? I mean,
well, of course it's not, and it's also leaving a legacy for thousands and thousands of years to come right across Libya, to make it a place where it's impossible to grow crops without actually getting radiation poisoning. All these kinds of, these weapons are absolutely disgusting, some of these weapons. And all that the various MPs, including Jeremy Corbyn, asked for in the House of Commons was a guarantee that these weapons of mass destruction were not going to be used in Libya. So in other words, that what they were doing was really going to be surgical, as the BBC keep telling us, and it wasn't going to lead to a massive humanitarian disaster afterwards, as we've seen in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, where these types of weapons have been used. So, you know, that's all I'd say about that. The other thing, of course, is that we've also heard over the weekend the Chinese and the Russians asking for a ceasefire and asking for the West to stop what they're doing, because they clearly have signed up, in a way, even though they didn't vote for the motion at the United Nations Security Council. They're now seeing this mission creep. They're saying, well, look, hang on a minute. We had a resolution at the United Nations for a no-fly zone, and you're now mission creeping. You're now changing the agenda, and you think you can do what you want. Now,
just hold on for there for a moment, Tony. We do have a caller. Hello, caller.
Hello, Islamicum, brother.
Where are you from?
I just want to ask Tony, I mean, you know, as a Muslim myself, I mean, from Pakistan originally, I mean, why should we feel sorry for, I mean, obviously I feel sorry for the innocent civilians, but why should the people of those countries who these dictators have been ruling for so many years, why should the people feel sorry for those dictators now that they're getting battered by the West, because they were the product of the West, and now the West is basically destroying these dictators.
But then couldn't you say the same thing about Pakistan? I mean, they've been battered by the West as well. I mean, every night there's drone attacks. I mean, should we then? I mean, if you ask a Libyan or an Iraqi or an Afghan, how would that feel like if they turned around and said, why should we feel sorry for you know?
No, I'll tell you why. Because as I said to you, I don't think you heard my full question that I asked. Why, apart from the civilians, we all feel sorry, but if Zardari tomorrow got bombed by the Americans, then, I mean, I would not feel sorry for him.
I don't think anybody in Pakistan would actually feel sorry for Zardari, to be honest with you.
That's my question. I mean, now that these products of the West, these dictators are being caned by the Americans, I'm just a layman on the road. I mean, why should I feel sorry for...
But the fact is, though, it's not actually hurting the dictator. It's actually killing civilians.
Well, let's if I could just intervene here. Let's have a look at what's happened in, particularly, in Iraq and Afghanistan, in these situations where the military from the West has intervened. What we see is basically puppet regimes, puppet dictators. People like Mohammed Karzai and in Iraq, a very similar situation, where you've actually got a regime which, although it does hold elections, the elections are corrupt, as we've seen in Afghanistan, absolutely, you know, ridiculous to suggest that Karzai was democratically elected. And you end up, it seems to me, in these countries where the West decides it's going to intervene, with a kind of proxy state which is being run at arm's length by the Europeans and the Western powers.
We are due a commercial break, just less than a minute away from the break. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM, Birmingham and the surrounding areas, myself, Saeed Ahmed, Tariq Zed, and Humayun, and with us, Steve Jolly and Tony Golding.
Look for the Facebook page, Behind the Headlines on Facebook. There you can listen to downloadable podcasts of our show on a weekly basis as well. About a good two or three months' worth of shows are available right now. 0120772 8892, and please join us after this short break.
Can you handle the truth? Behind the Headlines, RadioAuthority.net, 93.5 Unity FM.
You are listening to Unity FM 93.5 FM.
Can you handle the truth? Behind the Headlines, RadioAuthority.net, 93.5 Unity FM.
Cuts mean there'll be no new playgrounds for me and my friends. That'll teach me not to gamble on credit default swaps.
My allowance is being stopped, even though I've paid my taxes all my life. Guess I shouldn't have sold thousands of subprime mortgages to people I knew couldn't pay them back.
Cuts for maintenance allowances means I can't do A-levels. And anyways, even if I did, I couldn't afford to go to university. But I guess that's what I get for trading dodgy financial instruments.
We've been burgled 3 times, but the police numbers have been cut. Well, serves me right for crushing the global economy and demanding taxpayer bailouts.
The government wants you and your family to pay for clearing up a recession caused by greedy banks. Deep, rapid spending cuts will hit schools, the police, welfare, arts, and housing. More than 1 million will lose their jobs. People on average incomes, and especially the poor, will pay a heavy price. We're not all in this together. But whatever ministers say, it doesn't have to be this way. It's their political choice to try to close the deficit in 4 years, and to do it through cuts and VAT, rather than taxing those who caused the crisis, the banks and the super rich. What's worse is that these cuts are a false economy. The only sure way to close the deficit is to get the economy growing again. But the cuts threaten that. Adding 1 million to the dole queue and scrapping government orders to firms throughout the country is exactly the wrong thing to do. It's the same big mistake the world made back in the Great Depression. It's now ruining the Irish economy.
Thankfully, there are alternatives. A Robin Hood tax on the banks, cracking down on tax abuse, and putting the emphasis on green growth and investment. This not only deals with the deficit, but also with the unemployment, the poverty, and the many environmental challenges that the cuts will make worse. Doesn't that sound like a better future?
Absolutely, Unity FM 92.5, you are listening to Behind the Headlines. This is just after 9:30, Tuesday, the 29th of March, 2011.
You got that right for us. Just before we go back to Tony, just like to mention, as far as I know, I think that's also an advert which is produced by this group, False Economy. That's www.falseeconomy.org.uk.
Also, continue, Tarek.
And yes, like I say, you can go to their website, and they've got a whole website full of campaigns and actually explaining and breaking down the valid and viable alternatives to public spending cuts. Let's go back to Tony.
Just before we do, actually, also another event that's coming up tomorrow is at the House of Lords, I believe, Global Vision 2000, their conference or their seminar on economy and many other things besides, taking place tomorrow. That's the 30th of March at the House of Lords.
I've got another announcement which I'll make later as well for an event happening in Birmingham.
Yeah, and if you go to the Global Vision 2000 website, you'll find all the details there. They'll have you know, how you can attend the event possibly, and they got quite a few things going in that seminar, so check it out, globalvision.org, if I'm correct, Eric.
Globalvision2000.com, I think. I'll find it out.
We'll confirm that website for you very shortly.
Yeah.
Let's go back to Tony and
yeah, that site you mentioned, the False Economy website, is part of the Trade Union Congress, the TUC campaign. You know, you've obviously seen the stuff from the march on Saturday. Well, I mean, it's actually, what I've just said is a complete lie. We haven't seen the stuff from the march on Saturday. We certainly haven't seen the stuff from the rally. This is really frustrates me to see the entire media, and I put this on my Facebook page, the entire media focusing on the actual small amount of violence that there was, and none of the media actually reporting the brilliant speeches which were made in Hyde Park to roughly 500,000 people. So those people who were actually on the march got to see these speeches and got all rather stirred up by them and got to understand the situation, the political situation in Britain a lot better through having these speeches. And the thing I was so impressed with was Tony Robinson, you know, that does Time Team. He did a fantastic speech, which you can see on YouTube, which was uploaded by somebody. It wasn't the Socialist Workers' Party who uploaded some of the other ones onto YouTube. But, you know, without YouTube, we wouldn't actually be able to have any access to some of these most important speeches of the last decade, which were made in Hyde Park last Saturday. Another speech was made by Prunella Scales' son and Jeremy Irons' son. They're a couple of actors, you know, British actors. He's called Sam West. And he did a brilliant speech as well, which was all about, basically about art and about the way that the Conservative cuts immediately slashed the arts budget in this country, saying that actually art is something for everybody, and what's going to happen in the future is art is only going to be something which is available to the rich and the
like
whole
education,
society. And he was making the point as well that, that Michael Gove, the Education Secretary, who by the way is in this cult called the Bullingdon Club, which David Cameron and George Osborne and various other the cabinet members and various other sleazy characters were in when they were at Oxford, a drinking alcoholics club, a smashing things up club, and physically cutting and drawing blood of the members as they're initiated into it club, rather a nasty little thing. That Michael Gove is talking on the one hand about, oh, it's very important that children read books. On the other hand, he's actually closing libraries in schools and elsewhere. And also, he's actually closed the library at the Department of Education, would you believe, up in London. So if people who work at the Department of Education want to borrow a book, they have to sign a little chitty, and they can have it a few days later. They can't actually, you know, there's one of the cuts that he's done is to actually cut down books. This is perverse. Anyway, so that's really what I wanted to say, which is that what we haven't seen on the BBC or ITV or any other of our media, including indie media, would you believe, which is supposed to be a sort of alternative media, which actually didn't carry any of these speeches for whatever reason. And YouTube is the only place you can see them, and they are fantastic speeches. So I'd urge your listeners to actually go out there, track down TUC Hyde Park rally speech with Saturday's date, and you will find some fantastic, union leaders giving their opinions.
Well, if listeners,
the opinion which has been shut out by the BBC.
Yes.
The BBC is not doing its job. It really is not allowing the full spread of opinion, as it should be, to actually get out there into people's living rooms.
Well, to be honest with you, that just says a lot about the BBC's neutrality, doesn't it?
We did play, actually, a speech from Mark Sawatka at the beginning of our show.
Oh, great.
So I'll see if anyone catches a podcast, if, you know, they tune in a bit later when I catch the podcast, you can go to Behind the Headlines on Facebook, and I'm sure the podcast will be up there in the next couple of days,
yeah,
and you can catch our speech at the beginning.
Union.
This brings me on to a question, actually. Sorry, Steve.
About the coverage, I just wanted to say that I don't have a TV, so I haven't watched any of the news coverage, but obviously I've got the internet, and I've got to get a lot of stuff that way, and I've seen clips on YouTube about Saturday's protests, and you guys have probably seen this as well. There's clips going around that appear to show, or claim to show, undercover police up to no good. You know, there's a lot of focus on the criminal damage and the smashing the windows of the banks and stuff like that. There's a suggestion there, isn't there, that on some of these clips that the people doing that might actually be undercover cops. I mean, do you think that's something that goes on?
I think it definitely does. I mean, they're basically agents provocateurs.
Yeah.
The police who are out there actually trying to stir things up. I mean, I spoke to a guy who was a personal friend of the chauffeur of the Assistant Chief Constable of the Metropolitan Police years ago, and he said there was a big demonstration one Saturday, and he said, oh, he was out and about on Friday going round the far right-wing pubs in the east of London and actually recruiting people to come in and disrupt the march, cause violence, and so that the peaceful march could then be discredited. This is the Assistant Chief Constable of the Metropolitan Police back in the early 1990s. Actually, they're going out there to recruit the far right as agent provocateurs.
Wow, and then of course that is the bit that makes the newspapers, all the headlines. It ruins the message of the peaceful protest.
And unfortunately, that this Saturday, the 70 odd arrest and the 39, I think, injured, it made the headline more than what the actual march was about.
Well, I think there's going to be some sort of meeting taking place, actually, with regards to that base, about, you know, what to do with the situation of these people who are arrested and what's actually going to happen to them. I just want to bring a quick community announcement, actually, for Unity FM. Tomorrow, on the 30th, between 6.30 to 8.30, at the Muslim Student House, 517 Molesley Road, Borstal Heath, B12, 9BX, next to Molesley Baths, will be the concept of hijab, headscarf in Islam. That's part of the Islamic Awareness Week. It says, a look at the concept of hijab, head covering, and niqab, face veil, Islam, by Rihanna Sadiq from Reflection Network. The talk will also focus on current controversies surrounding these issues, followed by a Q&A session. There'll also be a finger buffet, so, you know, you want to miss that. And it's, if you want to phone, if you want to attend, can you let them know by phoning 0775-907-1343. Getting back to the conversation, one of the things I wanted to ask Tony, actually, is what he thinks of the TUC.
Well, the TUC is an interesting body, isn't it? I mean, I think it's been fairly neutered. I mean, our General Secretary in the Journalists Union, Jeremy Deer, is retiring soon from his job, but he's been actually on the General Counsel of the TUC, and he's been sort of steering it, I suppose, more towards the genuine socialist left. It seems it's quite a neutered organisation, generally. I mean, I think, for example, allowing Ed Miliband to speak at the anti-cuts march, when actually he isn't against the cuts, he is for cuts, not at least not so bad, was really just a kind of sop to the Labour Party. And this, you know, the Labour Party at the moment, ruled by Miliband, is actually not anti-cuts. And so, really, as far as I can see, Miliband is part of the problem. I mean, if we actually do believe that the bankers are responsible for the financial situation and that cuts are counterproductive and will actually have a very bad effect upon the economy, and that the government should actually take the bull by the horns, start reining back control of the nationalised banks and start spending into the economy, then what on earth is David Miliband doing actually even on the platform? Amazing, really, that the TUC would say, well, yeah, you know, even though this Labour Party is not against the cuts, let's give him a platform, where they haven't given a platform, but people like Caroline Lucas from the Green Party, who is very much anti-cuts, and actually I think much more articulate than David Miliband. I have a problem with the way that the TUC does these things, and I think having worked for the TUC for a while here in the South West, it's actually a very sort of soft left organisation with far too many ties into the sort of chambers of commerce, the business community, and I don't think it's actually all that much use. Having said that, it's very good that they pull together 500,000 people. It's just a pity that they chose Miliband to speak and not Caroline Lucas.
I was actually quite surprised that one Miliband actually made a speech at the demo, to be honest.
Yeah, well, that was what they broadcast, of course. The BBC put bits of Miliband's speech.
Yes, they did.
But you see, nobody else is, because he's pro-cuts. Well, this is real biased reporting, isn't it? We've got all this going on here at home. We've also got an extending, potentially anyway, crisis in the Middle East with more and more military intervention. The thing with this Libya thing, particularly, is that it really does look as if this is going to go on indefinitely. This is another one of those annoying wars, like Afghanistan, like Iraq, which seems as if it's going to be protracted for many years, if not a decade, maybe even more, because there certainly doesn't seem to be any easy conclusion. Gaddafi does have, whatever people might say, quite a good deal of support within Libya, and even if these rebels do overthrow Gaddafi, who's to say that the people who currently support Gaddafi are not going to continue this civil war? The other thing about it all, of course, is there could be blowback with potential attacks as...
Ken Clark.
Kenneth Clark was saying here in the UK. So it just seems like an absolutely insane thing to do for any government that really cares about its people and the representatives.
Well, I quote a little extract from Obama's address yesterday, Tony, that if we don't protect the people of Libya, then what kind of people are we? Well, and that's the line they're using at the moment to actually sell this unfortunate war to the people of the United States and the United Kingdom.
The people of Pakistan, for example, who are being bombed and killed by drones, which are US drones. The argument doesn't actually stand up, and there's a fantastic amount of double standards going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best thing to do is not to intervene anywhere, to allow people in their own countries to make their own decisions and sort their own things out. It seems to me when things go really wrong at home, as they are at the moment with our economy, that the idea of many politicians is simply to divert people's attention abroad, to say let's intervene abroad somewhere and create a whole load of a stink somewhere else, and that will actually make people forget about what the inadequacy of our policies at home. But anyway, the whole business of what's going on, obviously this is all leading towards a slow surrounding of Iran, and this is what bothers me, is that bit by bit, I mean, if you actually look on the map, now on the eastern border of Iran, Afghanistan and Pakistan are now pretty much, the US can do pretty much what it wants in there. It's got special forces on the ground all around the place, even going into Iran and doing covert operations in Iran. Obviously, Iraq is very much pro-US now. The US can do pretty much what it wants there with all its private military companies. The Turks are the also on the western side of Iran are the eastern flank of NATO and have now been brought into line, amazingly, to cooperate with the attacks on Libya as part of the NATO alliance. Iran, people in Iran must be getting really concerned. See, well, hang on a minute. It's like you're surrounding us. The only way out, of course, is up north towards Russia, through... places like Tbilisi, Rostov and Tashkent and up in that direction. So this is what bothers me, is that this is all part, as Wesley Clark said right at the very beginning, of a rolling campaign to put Western influence into almost all of the governments that they can in the Middle East and North Africa.
If I may come in here, Tony, that all these intervention in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Libya, I mean, is this all linked to a final showdown with Iran?
I think, if you take Wesley Clark seriously, and he was a Pentagon general in the US Army, let's not take his words lightly. Then, yes, and I find this all rather worrying, because, of course, what's going to happen in the Islamic world is that there's going to be a general feeling that people are not represented by hardly any of their governments. I mean, this is certainly a feeling in places like Saudi Arabia and Yemen, as we've seen, that there's a general feeling that we need to rise up and actually overthrow these people because they're not representing us anymore. And, you know, I think that there's some possibly some truth in what Moheen Yassin was saying a couple of weeks ago about there being some kind of general uprising in the Arab world, actually against Western influence, if this Western influence continues, as it seems to be doing in Libya. And then we are in a potential World War III type situation, you know, where really things could get very nasty. If the Western powers, and it's mostly the business interests, of course, that are behind this, have got their eyes on the eastern Libya oil, and they've got their hands now on the Iraqi oil, then, you know, you've got a situation where it may be that that will be then wrested from them, as it was in the Iranian Revolution. Then their reaction there may be actually, you know, really much more interventionist and much more draconian. That's what bothers me, is that that's the kind of scenario that this is building up very, very slowly, bit by bit, building towards. And then we've got a really serious state of affairs.
I think the key thing is very important to, you know, is, you know, those people who want peace needs to be very, very active here. I mean, there's a saying I've heard, you know, I'm going to paraphrase it, you know, I don't know the exact saying, that basically evil prevails because of the lack of people doing good, or the
good
people...
Well, that's actually a saying, which was a quote from a former Bristol MP, Edmund Burke, and he said the only thing that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. He said that back in the 1800s.
And that's very, very important right now.
There's a statue of him in the centre of Bristol here, where he's actually, you know, he says something very similar on the statue. But that's an Edmund Burke quote. He was an anti-slavery campaigner. Unfortunately, he was only an MP for one term. But, you know, that's, I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, what we've got to do is we've got to think to ourselves, well, hang on a minute. Rather than just shying away from this, let's try and get our heads around it. And I mean, it might sound a bit far-fetched, but I'm really attracted to the book The Lord of the Rings, and the way that that deals with these kind of big confrontations. Let's not forget that Tolkien, who wrote The Lord of the Rings, I don't know if you guys have seen the three films, have you?
I've seen read the books.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of people on the internet, even some people in the States, say, oh, this is really the devil's work, and this book is terrible, it's all got magic in it, and actually, they've completely missed the point, because Tolkien himself was writing in Oxford at the end of the Second World War, under the shadow of the threat from the Nazis, and during the war, this stuff. And he was basically putting together, I think is in a way, a sort of almost prophetic book about the way things work in the world. And the reason I say that is because of the symbolism he uses. He uses this very powerful symbolism. There's two main forces which are working against our hero, which is, you know, the sort of the hobbits and these various people. One of them is Saruman, who's a wizard, who's basically thrown his lot in with the evil one, the Dark Lord. And then there's the Dark Lord himself, Sauron. Sauron's symbol on the shields of all these little orcs that run around is the eye. The eye, and Sauron himself sits on the top of a great big hill in Mordor, and the eye, it seems to me, is pretty clear, is a symbol for the Illuminati. The white hand on the shield of the of Saruman, who's this wizard who's sold out, basically sold his soul to the devil, is the white hand is the Freemasons. Now, if you know anything about Freemasonry, you'll know that they all put these little white gloves on when they go into the Masonic lodges. And so that's what I think is going on there, is actually Tolkien is making a very, very clear message. And many people believe that Hitler himself was a Freemason, even though he banned Freemasonry. He realised how powerful Freemasonry was. He didn't want to have any other Freemasons, you know, sort of trying to steal his throne from him. So once he'd risen to power through the aid of Freemasonry, he then banned it in Nazi Germany. So you can see what I'm saying here is that actually Tolkien was looking at the kinds of pressures that there were on Christian civilization back in the 1940s under the Second World War, and he was interpreting it as actually this is a battle against the forces of darkness, even though it's there in The Lord of the Rings. It's actually also parallel in our modern society through these powerful symbols of the Sauron's eye being the Illuminati and Saruman's white hand or the shield of his orcs being Freemasonry. That actually rolls out into all sorts of other stuff. I don't know if you want me to talk about that in The Lord of the Rings, but I think that's the basic interpretation that I put on that. But I think he was being very smart. He was including these little clues and symbols. In fact, you know, he uses the runes in the book as a kind of hidden language, but actually there's a deeper meta-hidden language in the book to actually explain what he's talking about, which is we are fighting dark forces in Nazi Germany. And so those are the sort of parallels of the dark forces they're fighting in The Lord of the Rings. You know, we've got all these, I mentioned earlier on, these cults, which are now, it seems, at the heart of our government. You know, the Bullingdon Club, with several members of the Bullingdon Club actually now in the cabinet, these millionaires, now making very important decisions. It seems there's no longer any interest by the press into how much integrity these people have. They're certainly not going to resign if they're found to be an education secretary who's closing the library at the Department of Education. That seemed to be completely normal. Back in the past, of course, someone who did something like that would have to be forced to resign. But there is no pressure on them to resign anymore. So these, you know, we're moving towards a situation here in Britain which is rather getting rather like The Lord of the Rings. We've got a cult actually in the government and running the government. If you go back a couple of hundred years, you can look up this thing called the Hellfire Club, which was actually where the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time, Sir Francis Dashwood, was actually the leader of a cult where he would actually get prostitutes in and compromise members and bring them into this cult, which was at the heart of the British government of that time. So, you know, the Bullingdon Club, I think, you know, it's not quite the same as the Hellfire Club, but it's something certainly very similar, and there's no way that we should have these cults right in the centre of our government. I think that's absolutely madness.
Well, Tony, it's been a fascinating endeavour. Every show is fascinating, actually, as it happens, but as I say, time is our only enemy. So, just before we let you go, give us your last thoughts and tell us what's coming up
really
on BTFM.
I think, you know, watch the Lord of the Rings films again in this new light, if you've got them.
I'll tell you something, I'm going to go home and do it now.
And the other thing, of course, is there's two big countries in there. There's Rohan and there's Gondor. Gondor is a country which has been basically very good people, but the politics have been infiltrated. And I think you can look out now and see that exactly. So you've got this guy Wormtongue, who's there right inside the government, whispering all sorts of lies into the ears of the leader, a weak leader. And of course, that's the same sort of situation that we're in today.
I think
Gondor
it.
In the book represents Britain as it is now, and also there's Rohan, which is Ireland. I think, you know, these are the sort of parallels I would make. And Ireland is in a rather ahead of Britain in actually coming to some of these solutions, as Rohan is in The Lord of the Rings.
Absolutely.
Slightly ahead of the Gondor Empire.
So, Tony, what's coming up on BCFM this Friday?
Well, we've got a discussion on AV, actually. We've got somebody, you know, this new voting system that will be there's a referendum on coming soon. And we'll be having a discussion about the rights and wrongs of it. I've got a couple of people with very, very differing views, one saying that this is going to be a great thing and it's going to really enhance our democracy, and someone else from Ireland actually telling us all about what a disaster it's going to be and how awful it's been in Ireland. So we'll see if we can thrash out the truth from somewhere in between those two positions.
Tune in on Friday, www.bcfm.org, and catch the show live with the boys there, Martin Summers and Tony Gosling himself, 5 and 7 every Friday
evening.
We
have a minute left, so I just want to get a really quick last thought from our live studio,
thank you very
Steve
much.
Jolly, as well. Any of the topics that, you know, today you felt you wanted to really quickly comment on?
Well, fascinating. I can't comment on much on The Lord of the Rings. I think I've watched one or two of the films, but no, I mean, the subjects you guys cover on the show are really fascinating, and it's just, as you say, it's behind the headlines. You're not going to find out about this stuff on BBC One or read it in your daily newspaper to this extent of, you know, rummaging around in the background. So it's food for thought.
Indeed, come on.
My colleague, yeah, it's been a tremendous show, and I'm going to watch The Lord of the Rings, all three of them, tonight, just to see what Tony's been saying about the one eye and the white hand.
I think you should, because what Tony actually said is quite true, because it is a fascinating film, and I've read the books, and yes, I mean, it's an interesting, it makes a very, very interesting read. Mr. Ziad?
Yeah, my final thoughts are is that, you know, we should always look for a peaceful solution to things, and we should always stand up and make the things that matter count, and never be afraid. And as Tony's beautiful quote, which I still can't get, I paraphrase it again in simple terms, you got to do the right thing.
Absolutely. And we are going to do the right thing by going off air very, very shortly, by going home. And we will be back with you next week, Tuesday, same time, same place. My thanks to Steve Jolly, to Humayun, and to everyone who actually tried to, you know, been listening and called in. My thanks to all of you, to Tariq, and to everyone else who's been involved with this program. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM and www.radioyouthology.net. Until next week then, keep listening and keep the faith. Till then, good evening. And if you've got little ones, give them a kiss, give them a hug. Tell them you love them, because you just don't know what's around the corner.